Welcome to Season 2 of The Great Humbling. My name's Dugald Hine. I'm a writer and co-founder of a school called Home. Through the strange spring of 2020, I kept a weekly appointment with the futurist Ed Gillespie, where we would puzzle our way through the stories taking shape around the pandemic and how all this fits into a longer arc of social, political, and ecological crisis. We called these conversations The Great Humbling because we started from a sense that this is a time of being humbled, brought down to earth. And we wanted to ask what happens if we approach the moment we're in on those terms. Now we're back for a second season, where each week we'll be taking a state of mind that seems to be part of the mix of being alive just now. So this is The Great Humbling Season 2, Altered States. States of being, states of consciousness, and of course, the literal alteration of our nation states. Thanks for listening. Episode 6. This is the point where we put our cards on the table. Are we just playing around, or is it time to get serious? Is this episode going to be hard work, or will it turn out to be child's play? You've probably seen through this game by now, figured out what kind of state we're in this week. We're pondering the state of play. Ed, do you get enough play in your life?
As a full-time single father, I think most of my life is play, except when my daughter was at nursery. So I've been building robots this week. I've been realizing that my daughter enjoys the destruction of building blocks as much as the construction, which probably says something about my worldview in comparison to hers. And the fact that you can actually turn any task into play. So whether it's hanging out the washing or emptying the dishwasher, everything becomes a game. So yes, my life is replete with play.
Oh, my son's 5, so he's a couple of years older, I guess, than your daughter. And I can relate to a lot of that. As I'm standing here speaking to you, I'm looking through the door to our living room and the floor is covered with about 30 different jigsaws. Mostly the ones that he used to enjoy doing a couple of years ago when he was a bit smaller. And this Saturday, something magical happened. He got them out and he sat there. And for 2 hours, he played on his own with these jigsaws. And me and Anna were sat in the kitchen drinking our cups of tea going, what do we do? Like, it's the middle of the day and our child doesn't need us. So that was kind of a new experience and a premonition of how quickly we'll move on from the intensity of this stage of parenthood to a different kind of relationship. This summer, we were renting a car and driving around Sweden a bit, and Alfie wanted to listen to the radio and get these adverts that come again and again. And there's this one advert for Vuxenleksaker, which, if I translate it, you will get what it means. Adult toys. Alfie, age 5, is sitting in the back of the car. He's going, adult toys? What are adult toys?
I have to say, only in Sweden.
I think Anna said, well, jigsaws. but I remembered being not much older than he is now and asking my mum, do grown-ups play? Because if not, I had serious reservations about the prospect of growing up. So I guess we should ask each other the familiar question. What's been playing on our minds this week?
Well, over the weekend, I was participating and running a couple of sessions, an extraordinary online event organised by the House of Beautiful Business, which is a sort of fairly radical new business movement. I spoke at their event last year in Lisbon, which is called the Battle for Beautiful Business. And this year, they called it the Great Wave. And they'd already chosen that title and that theme way before the pandemic and everything has hit. So it felt very apposite. I did, along with my incredible Irish surfing buddy, Dr. Easky Britton, who is like a kind of cold water, big wave surfer from Donegal Bay. Who, you know, if you ever want to be humbled, you just have to talk to Easky and see some of her footage. And we did this beautiful love letter to the ocean together. I organized a wild solo, and it was just this amazing, you know, melange of art, dance, musical performance, extraordinary talks and sessions with everyone from the Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong to quantum physicist Shahini Ghosh. In terms of the context of play, it really got me thinking, because there's a couple of things that the House of Beautiful Business do which I think really embody what we're talking about today. And last year, I sang in their, what they call their Fight Club Choir, which they brought together over the 3 days. And we had three rehearsals, and we learnt Bella Ciao, you know, classic Italian partisan song, and Katy Perry's Raw. And it was amazing. And so we sang these on the last night. And then after all the kind of formalities had wound up, for the last hour between 11 o'clock and midnight, they do what they call a silent farewell. And the whole room falls into this quite ethereal silence. You know, it's hundreds of people in there. And we did it, obviously, in a Zoom session this time. But last year, I just remember the absolute magic of this silent playfulness. You know, people sort of writing handwritten notes to each other, these spontaneous collective mimes popping up, lots of hugs and smiles. And it was really gentle. And at the end of the hour, we all processed silently out into the Praça do Comércio, the big plaza in the center of Lisbon. We did one more rendition of Bella Ciao together, and then we did an Ocean's 11 departure, where everyone just in silence just walked off in different directions.
Wow. Yeah, I love that idea for how to end an event. I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, we'll say, I think if you like it, nick it.
Yeah. So this week I was going to say I was reading, but actually, honestly, I was listening to, because a lot of the fiction in my life these days I get as audiobooks. And so this week my listening was Neil Gaiman's novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which I enjoyed very much. And partway through, I realised that it was a particular kind of enjoyment, because what it is a children's book for grown-ups. And the frame of the story involves a man in his 40s who's come back to the area where he grew up. But the main narrative inside of this frame is him remembering the strange series of events that happened at the age of 7. And Gaiman actually gave a lecture around the time he wrote the book called What the Very Bad Swear Word Is a Children's Book Anyway, which came out of his experience of wrestling with this novel and whether it was a book for children or for grown-ups. And all the way through the novel, he's got these passages about children's literature. He really evokes the way that you can lose yourself in a book when you're 7 or 8 years old, if you're a particular kind of child. And he brings in Narnia, and he brings in girls' school novels of the 1930s and 40s, sort of sub-Enid Blyton stuff, but in a really appreciative way of the role that books can play for children. But actually, the writer that the book brought most to mind for me was one that he didn't mention, because he was probably not quite of the generation that Gaiman grew up reading, but that was Robert Westall. I mean, he's best known for The Machine Gunners, but there are a couple of other books of his, The Wind Eye and Urn Burial, that really stick in my mind for the experience of reading them as a child. And I think I had that experience listening to The Ocean at the End of the Lane in a way that I haven't had very often in the last 2 or 3 decades. But there's a question that's sort of buried in Gaiman's book, which is this just escapism and a sort of comfort food? Or is there something that's gone missing from our ways of being grown up? Is there a thread that we drop on the way from childhood? And clearly the way that Gaiman talks about myth, there is a sense that myths and fairy tales used to be everybody's stories. They were our indigenous carriers of culture. And at a certain point, historically, they got put away into the attic, like toys that we'd grown out of, that now they're only for children. And it's curious to twine this thought that maybe there's something missing from our ways of being grown up around that suggestion I brought up last week, talking about Hugh Brody's accounts of living and working with Inuit people and other indigenous groups, that suggestion that ours is a culture which doesn't have many grown-ups, that we don't really grow up at all. And I think both these things can be true, and maybe the hinge between these two seemingly contradictory truths might have something to do with play.
It's always revealing to go back to some of the etymological roots, you know, and find the richness that is often hidden behind the kind of the simple interpretation of the word. Play comes from the Old English plegian, to exercise, or plega, which is brisk movement. And that's related to the Middle Dutch pleien, to leap for joy or dance. So there's very much this sort of movement and dancing and joyfulness embedded in it. But then there's the sort of proto-West Germanic root, which is to care about or to be concerned with, like where we might put our attention. But also the Old English play on, which is to risk or into endanger. And, you know, we call this episode State of Play, which is it's a peculiarly British expression. And actually, I think usually implies precisely the opposite. When we talk about a state of play, we're not really talking about play at all. And then, of course, there's the idea of being played, to have a joke or trick played upon you. But I mean, play appears to be its own reward by being intrinsically enjoyable. And we don't play necessarily because it's good for us, or necessarily because we'll learn from it or change because of it. We play at heart just because it's fun. It's really about rule breaking.
Well, isn't there a doubleness here? Because play is both about making and breaking rules. It's like you create a game by setting up rules, but it ceases to be playful if the rules become too rigid. Like the creativity is the finding the ways of innovating around the rules or whatever.
That reminds me of Ian M. Banks and his sci-fi books, because he would write his own rules in order to break them, in order to surprise you and wrong foot you. But I think play is about being open and vulnerable and loose and present. You have to let yourself out to play. You have to recognize the opportunity and have the courage to take it. I mean, that said, we all cringe when someone suggests role play.
So, better books than Leksaka here, aren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah. So there is this sort of permission to act and to lose control in public and play the fool, and to perhaps let that inner humor radiate out. That requires us to abandon, you know, our so-called competence, our professionalism, our norms, you know, or even our self-importance. It's about the silliness, laughing at ourselves, even in positions of discomfort. You know, we know about this in the sort of dance like no one's watching, sing like no one's listening, you know.
Draw like you're 5 years old.
Draw like you're 5 years old, exactly. You know, in that sense, play is a wandering. And it can also be dangerous. I think coming back to that endangerment and risk, play can be a bit naughty.
As the Swedish adverts tell us, I'm listening to this, I'm remembering that there's actually this old song that runs through Neil Gaiman's novel, which is girls and boys come out to play. The moon shall shine as bright as day. And the line in it is, come with a whole heart or not at all, which is a lovely line of invitation. You touched on this thing of intrinsic enjoyment, which brings up another thread that runs through all of this. Because to talk about play is also to bring work into play, because play and work are often set up as opposites, often experienced as opposites. And there was a famous experiment by a psychologist called Edward Deci, getting grown-ups to play with toys to test what money does to our relationship with a task. So basically, he had people playing with these cubes that are a bit like sort of 3D wooden Tetris blocks. He told the adult students who were taking part in the experiment that they were being observed during this time-limited period, and then the observer appeared to leave the room, and while they were waiting around, he was keeping an eye on, did they carry on playing with these toys or not? And he had one group who were being paid $1 for every solution during the official timed period of the experiment, and the other group weren't being paid. And what he noticed was, if you're being paid to do a task, when you stop being paid to do it, you're less likely to go on doing it. Deci's explanation of this is that when money gets involved, our locus of motivation, our sense of why we're doing this, moves from being intrinsic to being extrinsic. We're doing it because we're being paid to, because we're being told to. And we lose that playful, intrinsic relationship that might actually have been there to the work we're doing. I was thinking about this week because obviously on some British Facebook, there's been a lot of drama around this poster, Fatima's next job could be in cyber, which turns out to come from a campaign that ended in March. It's a little bit unclear whether there was any official role in it resurfacing at this point, but obviously it resonated with stories that were already going around about government telling artists to, you know, go off and retrain. I don't go in for conspiracy theories that much, but wouldn't surprise me if there's somebody around Dominic Cummings who was quite happily getting this poster into circulation to stoke the outrage of those who in one way or another identify as part of the arts community. Because, and I say this with love and as somebody who has been one foot in the arts community most of my life, we can be pretty blind about how we come across to the rest of society. And Emma Wallace's piece that we talked about last week, the description of the different response she got to the identity of the artist versus the monk, brings this into view. Now, and part of this is that within the version of being grown up that has dominated in modern societies, the artist has been this exception, the one kind of grown up who's allowed to go out in public without wearing the clothes of economic rationality. In theory, at least, as an artist, you are licensed to be playful and not to have to justify your work directly by its usefulness and its efficiency in the way that pretty much everybody else in society is expected to justify their work. And there's some level at which that generates a justifiable resentment, which I think can very easily be leveraged in the kind of culture war games that some of the dark forces in contemporary politics are playing. I've sometimes thought that really the only legitimate form of state funding for the arts is a universal basic income, because anything else is creating this special caste of people who are, under certain conditions, liberated from a set of pressures that form the lives of a huge part of the rest of the population. And the irony of this is that if you look historically in the UK, then the benefits system and even things like YTS schemes in the 80s did kind of sort of play that role for a while.
I was chatting with Brian Eno last weekend.
As you did.
I don't mean that in a name-dropping sense, but it's very relevant because it had a visit immediately before me from a young aspiring local artist in order to get some advice, you know, on how to get on in the art world. And I said to Brian jokingly, I said, "So what advice did you give her, Brian?" And he went, "Don't get a job." which is easy to say, but obviously he was part of that generation that genuinely benefited from the dole to allow them space to explore their creativity.
So I was thinking about Emma's thing of the artist identity and the monk identity as I was reading this essay called Reading Ecstasis by the poet Gail Marie Thompson. And she says, ecstasis, so this is the Greek word from which we get the word ecstasy. Ecstasis is not antistasis, the opposite position. Ecstasis is not even on the spectrum of position. It's outside of position. And the thought that came to me is the artist role is a position, a privileged and precarious one within the spectrum of positions available and legible in a modern society. Whereas the monk isn't even on that spectrum. The monk is just outside of the game of modern society. It's an anachronism that isn't really meant to exist anymore and certainly doesn't matter and doesn't hold kind of cultural power or capital in the way that the artist sometimes can. The artist is a bit like a knight on a chessboard. It's the piece that can hop over and move at strange angles that no other piece can do. Whereas the monk is more like saying, maybe we could play a different game altogether where most of you weren't stuck being pawns.
And I think that comes back to the figure of the court jester or the fool who's captured imaginations, you know, for centuries. And the fool in the traditional sense is sort of part actor, part comedian, part soothsayer. But they're trying to get us to laugh at our own human folly and often, you know, shine some quite uncomfortable light into the dark recesses of our egos. And the best example, I don't know if you've ever come across the work of the incredible Jonathan Kay.
No, I haven't.
He's quite astonishing. You know, he's one of those one-off type of individuals. He runs the Theatre of Immediacy and also the Travelling Nomadic Academy of Fools. I first saw him in a pub in Brixton doing a very, very small-scale thing, and I was mesmerised. And so I booked him for my venue at Shambhala, the Emporium of Unimaginable Insights. Invariably, he'd start off with an audience inside the tent, but it would only be a matter of minutes before, you know, Jonathan would lead them, like the Pied Piper, out into the festival, giving people spontaneous standing ovations, you know, creating a sort of avenue of claps that people would walk down like it was some kind of catwalk. We'd have kissing races. people would be sunbathing in the sunshine, you know, blissed out on festival cider, and open their eyes to find themselves surrounded by 40 people who are worshipping them as some unlikely deity. Or we'd have... You'd have a whole gang of people shoaling as fish through the festival crowd. And my favourite was he'd get the whole group to practice singing, you know, all we are saying is give peace a chance. And then we'd sing that, but then we'd sing it manically or hugely aggressively. And then if people didn't respond, you know, you get this chorus of people sticking their fingers up and shouting, fuck off. It was the sort of maddest flash mob imaginable. As Jonathan says, the act of thinking is improvisational theatre's most immediate and persistent assassin. And he goes, fool's job is to frighten people. You know, it's to encourage that danger. It's to whistle while you're taking people to the cliff edge. But crucially, and this is where I think his magic really lies, he says you've got to win the audience so they give you that license. Otherwise, they won't see you as a fool, but as somebody saying things they've got no permission to say. And he says, I couldn't do it if there wasn't a positive aspect, because then it would just be insulting. And his underlying theory is that, you know, we've all got two people inside of us. One is the dictator, and the other is the fool. And the dictator is the person inside who says, don't, can't, shouldn't, mustn't. All of this self-policing that goes on. And to play the fool, we've got to get rid of that dictator and work with our own impulses and instantaneous actions and reactions.
I love the sound of Jonathan Kay. I can't believe I'd never come across him. It's making me think about Keith Johnstone, who's really the genius of modern comedy improvisation and much else. Part of what's fascinating about Johnston is that he didn't develop his techniques as a specialist performance skill. I mean, he went on to work with the Royal Court Theatre and then to create all sorts of impro crews and so on. But he started out as a teacher in his 20s in London in the 1950s, being given the class of the kids who were meant to be unteachable. And he developed these techniques in figuring out what they could do together. And if you read, there's two books that Johnston's written, Impro and Impro for Storytellers. If you read them, you get this very clear picture of the relationship between education or schooling and the practice that he has. He talks about what schooling does to us. He talks about the realization of how his body had become tightened up, closed down, stuck, as a result of the lessons, spoken and unspoken, that school had taught him, first as a student and then as a teacher. And at one point he says, people think of good and bad teachers as engaged in the same activity, as if education was a substance, and that bad teachers supply a little of the substance, and good teachers supply a lot. And this makes it difficult to understand that education can be a destructive process, and that bad teachers are wrecking talent, and that good and bad teachers are engaged in opposite activities.
Weirdly, I actually made contact. There's a sad death of an old school associate of mine last week, but it also prompted a connection with my old biology teacher, who was one of those teachers I always refer to when people ask you, you know, who's the teacher you remember? And Dave Knott was the one, because he was seriously funny, you know, and he taught us and worked with us like complete adults. And it was quite anarchic. What you're saying there is actually really resonant with what Tyson Yunker Porter writes about education. A story he tells about Prussia, which is essentially a yarn. It's about how Prussia, in terms of power and control of the people, engaged in manufactured adolescence of young people and in order to domesticate people for the purposes of control. And as Tyson says, he goes, it's an outrageous yarn. He goes, it's probably the most ludicrous incendiary rant that has ever fallen from my lips. But in terms of the playfulness, it's incredibly provocative and fun, and really makes you think about the fundamental notion of education, which then connected into another rant I spotted on Facebook this week, which is doing the rounds, from American writer David Bowles, who's quite a successful sci-fi writer, and he has a doctorate in education. And he basically says, education as we know it is barely 100 years old. He goes, our understanding of how learning happens is like astronomy 2,000 years ago. Most classroom practice is actually astrology, you know, and his proposition was that actually kids learn to liberate themselves and their communities through their own powerful sense of natural injustice. And in essence, a lot of what we do in terms of the implementation of education is to basically break their souls.
Yeah, I've seen that post going around, and I don't have a PhD in education or in anything else. I was once a senior visiting fellow in education policy at the University of Lincoln.
You have so many jobs. I would love to see your full CV one day.
I'd love to try and write it. I don't know. That was the most impressive sounding academic role I've had. I'm not sure what it meant. But if anything, I'd say things are worse than the picture that Bowles is giving, because when you talk about it in terms of, well, you know, we're kind of on the threshold of moving from astrology to primitive astronomy, you've got this kind of linear curve of progress going on there. The truth is that we've destroyed or marginalized a lot of what humans have known over time about how you bring up children to be active participants within their communities and capable of holding responsibility. And we've done it because we needed a different kind of human being for modern industrial societies. If you look at the history of the schooling systems we've inherited, they have this kind of twin origin. On the one hand, to rescue children from the new horrors of the industrial workplace. And on the other hand, to breed adults who would tolerate the horrors of the modern industrial workplace. Part of the reason why child labour became such a big thing in the early factories was because they found that if you hired adult men, they smashed up the machines because they were not prepared to tolerate this new brutal simplification of life that was actually what the early generations of industrialisation were like. And instead, if you get children doing meaningless tasks all day for years, then by the time they are big enough to smash things up, they've been inured to the meaninglessness of activity and to discipline. And we got rid of a lot of the obviously brutal aspects of industrial work and of industrial schooling. But the same principles are still baked into the systems. Mm. You know, in one of his later texts, Ivan Illich says, this is going to sound horrific, but I feel like the good teachers within modern schooling systems have to play an equivalent role to Oskar Schindler during the Holocaust. That actually, you know, your role is not to reform the system, but simply to shelter as many people as possible from the inbuilt dynamics of the system. So where to go from that? And what I see in Keith Johnston's improvisation, and I love how close to the surface this is in the way he writes about it, is it's not a special performance skill. It's a practice of coming alive. And years ago, an old girlfriend of mine was involved with a comedy club, and I used to help out on the door. And so for a couple of years, I saw a lot of live stand-up comedy. And I came out of that experience deeply impressed by what it takes to do that. And I've sometimes said stand-up comedy is the one shamanic tradition indigenous to modern Western urban culture.
Having done a stand-up comedy course, it was the single most terrifying thing I've ever done in terms of performance.
Well, so what I see in it is like anything that has shamanism in the name today in a modern white Western context is in danger of being battle reenactment, pretending that it's war, because people want to believe in it. Whereas a good comedy club with a discerning audience, the audience starts leaning back with its arms folded going, go on then, show us what you can do.
Yeah.
And the comedian has to draw people out of that and then fuse the room into a kind of collective consciousness and then ride that and take it different ways. Mm. And you can succeed or fail at doing it. You can also succeed in cheap ways, and you can succeed in really daring, rare, special ways. And I've seen all of those things happen. So if stand-up comedy is the one shamanic tradition indigenous to modern Western urban culture, and I'd say Alcoholics Anonymous is the one initiatory order indigenous to modern Western urban culture, then the improvisation tradition that springs from Keith Johnston's work, for me, is the closest thing I know to a modern Western urban form of tantra that isn't just spiritual colonialism pillaging other people's traditions. And still, having said that, there's a tantalizing detail in one of Johnston's books when he talks about the moment that the spell his schooling had cast on him broke. And he's watching this film from 1930 by Alexander Dovchenko, this Ukrainian filmmaker, film called Earth. And it's this scene where the hero is walking alone in the twilight, walking and walking through a village that resembles a Chagall painting. And there are peasants in the fields together at twilight, and we're sort of following change in the hero's mood from the anxiety and threat into participating in and being filled by the ecstasy of these peasants around him. And he starts to dance. And Johnston says, the dust swirls around his feet so that he's like an Indian god, like Shiva. And he says, in one moment, I knew that the valuing of men by their intelligence is crazy, that the peasant watching the night sky might feel more than I feel, that the man who dances might be superior to myself, word-bound and unable to dance. And for me, that's a description of a kind of humbling ecstasy. And it makes me think of there's a moment of ecstasy in The Ocean at the End of the Lane, this Neil Gaiman novel, when the boy plunges into the ocean that can be a duck pond or even contained in a bucket. And he goes under and discovers that he can breathe water in some strange way. And this is a bit like the Piper at the Gates of Dawn scene from Wind in the Willows that you talked about a few weeks ago. He has this experience of being part of everything and knowing everything. And he also learns that if he stays in this state for long, he will dissolve into everything. He will cease to exist as a self. And afterwards, he asks Letty, who's the older girl who is part of this mysterious trinity of women at the heart of the novel, whether this is what it's like for her all the time, whether she knows everything. And she says, be boring knowing everything. You have to give that stuff up if you're going to muck about here.
Oh, I love that. I love that. It's funny, that connection of being part of everything, though. I mean, there's a couple of theatre things that I've done in London in the last few years. I mean, people are probably familiar with the work of Punch Drunk and the sort of promenade theatre and the immersive theatre where, you know, the play takes place in a non-linear fashion and repeats a couple of times over the course of the evening, and you follow it in the way that, you know, your own emotions draw you, and you can follow a particular character and follow their thread. And that's interesting in terms of a completely different immersion in the story and a connection into it. And it does obviously blur those lines. So you're less of an observer and you feel more of a participant. But perhaps the most extreme example of that is, have you ever heard of You, Me, Bum Bum Train?
The name rings a strange bell. It sounds like it might come from a Swedish radio advert.
Exactly. That's the theme of the podcast today. No, You, Me, Bum Bum Train, I mean, it's essentially a cast of hundreds and an audience of one. But actually, as the audience, you are the performer. And it's a series of vignettes. You're either giving a pep talk to a sports team who are having a terrible time, and it's the halftime motivational speech you've got to give, or you find yourself in a pulpit giving a sermon with a gospel choir echoing your words behind you, or you arrive in a bookshop to sign your own book. And you're being interrogated by journalists as to what your inspiration was behind the particular work. I mean, it's very rapid fire. You know, you go through a dozen different scenes in about 45 minutes. I volunteered as an actor, because obviously it relies massively on volunteer time. And essentially you have to do the same scene 80 times in a night. It's quite exhausting. But it's extraordinary in terms of the way that people react, in terms of letting themselves go. Some people are just paralyzed with shock. Others, you know, you can see them unleash their completely inner spontaneity and totally rise to the occasion.
This thing about playing roles takes me back to my time in a Hindu cult. Now, we were sort of...
This is not on the CV, is it?
This is not on the CV. We were a sort of fairly feral, provisional gang. I'm not sure we were worthy of the word cult, and I don't claim any identity or authority to speak about Hinduism. But I did learn a lot from, you know, a couple of the people who I was involved with at that point in my life. And, you know, one of their teachings was the whole of reality is God in drag. Like that image from Neil Gaiman of being part of everything and you have to forget it. You have to give that stuff up if you're going to muck about here. That really all of us are parts of the divine playing with the dressing up box. And one of the things that that teaching gives you is a certain metaphysical etiquette, because if everybody you are dealing with is a god wearing dressing up clothes, then don't be surprised if when you treat them in a way that doesn't respect that, the force that comes back at you doesn't resemble the clothing they're currently wearing, but comes from the underlying divine presence there. And another part of the teaching was that, you know, the Hindu understanding of enlightenment, unlike what I've often heard from friends who are into Buddhism, where it feels like, you know, the story is the world is made of suffering and enlightenment is a kind of ejector seat escaping from it. The Hindu version of enlightenment, as it was taught to me, is about the revelation of Leela. The thing you encounter when you cross the threshold is this experience of the underlying pattern of play. That's what the word Leela means, that is the fabric of all of reality.
If play is the underlying fabric, that's really interesting. And with my sort of scientist hat on, and I don't want to go back into a sort of reductionist approach, but it's really interesting when you look at play in animals, because, you know, every natural history program will have some kind of pontificating commentator in an Attenborough tone telling you that animals play to prepare for adulthood. And it turns out that that's sort of bollocks. You know, whether it's, you know, we've probably seen the YouTube videos of the mudsliding elephants or the sledging crows. But actually, fun is rather costly and perilous from a sort of biological perspective. It doesn't actually make much evolutionary sense. And most of the you know, the so-called practice behaviors like play fighting or, you know, chasing each other to practice escaping routines from predators, doesn't really give the animal any real advantage, according to our understanding.
You know, the scientific angle on it doesn't have to reduce it all. What I get from your description of the way that the play and fun among animals doesn't make sense in this cost-benefit evolutionary analysis is, yeah, they're participating in the play of the world. There is a joy in the moments of abundance that is what makes life worth living, and that is not exclusive to creatures like us. And if we paid more attention, then we might find it harder to imagine that we are so separate from all these other creatures that we share the world with. I guess there's one last piece, picking up on something I talked about a few weeks ago, and it has to do with the role of the past, because it belongs to this thread of improvisation. And we had an interesting comment this week from Dan Knaus asking if this turning to the past isn't about nostalgia. And I can only answer that in my understanding of things, nostalgia, romanticism, conservatism are all modes of turning to and using the past. They all carry warning signs for me, but they don't exhaust the possibilities of the past. And Johnston's improvisation work is actually at the heart of how I arrived at this way of seeing things. Because improvisation is literally the absence of foresight. It's being improvident, which is almost the worst vice of modern capitalist society, having failed to provide for yourself and your household for the future. It's being improvident and elevating that to a virtue, the skill of being okay with not being able to see what's coming next, of stumbling backwards foolishly into the future rather than, you know, striding out heroically into it. And that thing of traveling backwards into the future, there's a kind of dark vision of that in Walter Benjamin's Angel of History text, where he has this image of the angel who can see the pattern in the mess that we are all just experiencing being in the middle of, and could change it, except that there is this wind blowing, a storm blowing from paradise that's caught in the angel's wings and blowing the angel backwards into the future so he can't turn back and fix things. Well, Johnston has this line about how you improvise a story, which to me turns Benjamin's image around. He says, when you're improvising a story, you shouldn't worry about what's coming next. You should be like somebody walking backwards, looking for the moment when you can pick up a thread from earlier in the story and weave it back in. And he says, that's the most satisfying moment for you as a storyteller and for the audience. And my suspicion about why it's so satisfying is because I think the experience of meaning is closely connected to those kinds of moments when the past turns out to still be relevant, still be present, still be capable of being worked into the story in the present. There's no going back. There's no point in the past that we would want to go back to, even if our time machine could go in both directions and had more gears than one. But whereas the future is this blank screen onto which we project things from the way we see things just now, and it can never draw our attention to the assumptions, including the assumptions we don't even know we're making just now, around here. The past has clues for us. We pay attention to it. It can dislodge our current assumptions and ways of seeing and help us see possibilities that we might be missing.
Mm. It always brings me back in some way, shape or form to Martin Shaw in his masterful storytelling. Is a great and deft weaver of recurrent tropes and ideas from earlier in the story that, you know, are often where the entertainment and the real insight genuinely lies. And I love the way, you know, he often inserts contemporary cultural references into ancient myths, you know, so a hero will be embarking on a journey on his horse with a frappuccino in their hand, or, you know, he'll make a reference to a YouTube video or flicking through something on your iPhone, or insert some of his teenage daughter's youth speak into the mouth of a character. But yeah, I wanted to finish on another example and set of stories around the former mayor of Bogota, Antanas Mockus. He was a former philosophy professor who was actually forced to resign after he mooned an auditorium of disruptive students.
Didn't know that bit.
So he's the master of playful social experiments. And he once hired 420 mime artists to make fun of traffic violators because he believed Colombians feared ridicule more than being fined. And he also cut the homicide rate by an impressive 70% in Bogota and traffic fatalities by more than 50%. He used to dress as a super citizen in spandex, took a shower live on air to encourage water saving, and introduced women-only nights out on the town. And I think, yeah, he genuinely knew the power of playfulness in politics in order to get people to experience their better selves. And he said he even tells a story about once being sort of accosted almost physically in the street by someone who pretty much grabbed him by the lapels, looked slightly madly into his eyes and said, "You make me want to be a better man." It was really, you know, something quite extraordinary. So I'll finish on something playful from one of my favourite authors, Kurt Vonnegut, who actually, it's almost surprising in a way that hasn't popped up earlier in our wanderings. Kurt famously says, you know, the arts are not a way to make a living. They're a very human way of making life more bearable. Practicing an art, no matter how well or badly, is a way to make your soul grow, for heaven's sake. Sing in the shower, dance to the radio, tell stories, write a poem to a friend, even a lousy poem. But do it as well as you possibly can, because you will get an enormous reward. You will have created something. And I think he pretty much encapsulates that in one line, saying, "We're here on Earth to fart around and don't let anybody tell you any different." So, ladies, gentlemen, friends, listeners, let us play.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with and needs a little time and space to breathe. If you are new to the podcast, please do revisit season one, as we are aiming to build on ideas, insights and narratives already touched upon. And together, this will hopefully enable us all to make a little more sense of these strange times we are living through. Please do comment, ask questions and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or via my Twitter account, @Frucall. And we would obviously deeply appreciate and be grateful for any ratings, reviews, recommendations or sharing you might feel compelled to contribute as a result of listening. Our title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions, used gratefully under a Creative Commons license. We're living in a time of humbling, an initiation at a cultural scale. Please join us on this emergent journey.